Welcome to Word Balloon. This is John Suntress. Today, we carpool with Jeff Loeb after he dropped his daughter off at school and drives through the L.A. Valley on his way to work. You'll hear the traffic sounds to prove it. In this earnest discussion, Jeff finds himself in a moment of personal and professional transition. Many fans have heard about the Loeb family's loss of their son, Sam, who passed away this summer after a lengthy battle with cancer. Sam was only 17, but had already started to follow his father's career, writing stories for Dark Horse and DC Comics, and making plenty of professional friendships that continue in honor of his far too short life. Changes at home have led to professional changes. The longtime DC writer is wrapping up work on the team-up hit Superman Batman and the revamped original Supergirl, sowing the seeds of his contributions to the all-titles crossover story Infinite Crisis. Earlier this spring, Jeff finished 3 years of stellar work writing for the TV series Smallville. This fall, he's begun work on Marvel Comics' alternate take on the Avengers, The Ultimates, and has joined the writer's staff of ABC Television's hit series Lost. Our conversation begins with a look at Jeff's take on the iconic partnership of DC Comics' greatest heroes. Let's start with Batman Superman. It seems like you're close to the end of your story.
I'm very close to the end of the run on Superman Batman.
A little play on The Ultimates?
I don't know that I see it that way. I just think that they're, they're kind of the ultimate heroes that would be in DC. or the maximum heroes, as they would be. But, yes, I'm having fun, and it's not just to poke a stick in the eye. There's actually a whole larger plan about the nature of who Superman and Batman are, not just to the world. Let me sort of back up and say that the way that the series was designed, and yes, unbelievably or not, I actually had a plan, and that was to work from the inside out, and that was the first 6 issues, which is now collected as Public Enemies, was how the heroes see each other, Superman and Batman. And the next 6 issues, which is the Supergirl arc, which is also collected, is how other people see them. And then the third arc, which I do with Carlos Pacheco, Absolute Power, is about how the world sees them. And that's why there were so many different timelines, so that you could see what they would be like in different timelines. And then the last is how the role that they play within the universe. And when I say the universe, it's the universe theoretically encompasses everything. I don't necessarily prescribe the notion that there are different universes. I think it's just one big giant thing out there, and eventually it starts to repeat itself. And I'm not sure whether or not that's a science or whether or not I've just made that up.
And a lot of your story elements had the seeds of what DC is running through now with Infinite Crisis.
All of that was plotted out and planned, and it certainly helped that the guy who's the architect of Crisis, Jeff Johns, is my studio mate, and I see every day, and sits about 8 feet from me. So if, you know, we go out to lunch and think of cool stuff, and I play whatever I can play, and it's just part of what's the fun of Superman and Batman is that you can read those stories all by themselves, and not have any understanding of what goes on in the DCU, and you can read those stories and have complete understanding of the DCU and recognize that these are the thing that I love to do, which is to tell stories within the pages of the stories that you already know. And continuity fans out there can spend most of their lives trying to figure out when all this stuff happens. It's there. It'll work. You know, it's something that Eddie Braganzen and I work very hard at. It's not as though we're just running around. But by the same token, it should very much feel like when Grant Morrison and Howard Porter were doing the JLA, you know, I mean, the first arc in the JLA was that the Martians took over the world. Mm-hmm. And yet, in every other DC book, there weren't any Martians. And, you know, I happen to believe that comics are the way that they were when I grew up. And that was that, you know, Wolverine was in Madripoor and out in the Shi'ar Empire and also with Cap in World War II. And the way that comics work in my brain is that, you know, Superman on Monday is in Action Comics, and on Tuesday is in Superman Comics, and on Wednesday is in Superman Batman, and on Thursday is in Adventures of Superman. And on Friday, he's lying around in bed with Lois, and we don't get to see that scene. One of the things that, you know, is important about these stories is that when you stop and you look at how long they actually take place, even though some of the arcs feel like it took a year to come out, some of them only take place in the space of sometimes a week, sometimes not much more than that. And, you know, in the case of Absolute Power, the way the story is constructed is that it took no time. People are back actually where they were at the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
And the story that we're doing right now is that every single story begins where the last one left off. So theoretically, this entire story is taking place over about a 24 to 48 hour period. And I think that's where people get hung up in terms of how it fits into anything. You just have to go, well, this is Tuesday. And, you know, on Thursday, the Justice League Tower blew up. But that hasn't happened yet.
No, I got you. At the end of your run, is it going to be one big story? I mean, obviously, thematically, when we step back, will these 25 issues make up one big story?
In a way that you don't have to read all 25 in order to know that, but in a way that it's not going to, nothing's going to be ignored. You know, there are things that we're slowly starting to sew up. I mean, the fact that the future Superman that appeared in issue 2 resolved itself in Absolute Power is what it is.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't have to have read Public Enemies, that arc, in order to understand who this guy is. All you need to know is that if you're reading Absolute Power, there's a Superman in the future who's angry that they've screwed things up. And now he has to go back. Now, he does say, I have to go back again. And if you've never read this book, you go, okay, well, obviously he went back before, but you don't need to know that. During the course of Absolute Power, there's a bargain that is made with Darkseid. Now, the question just is, when time realigned itself, does Darkseid remember that? Does anybody remember that?
Mm-hmm.
Well, we know that Superman and Batman remember it, so now the question becomes, when is that debt going to get paid? And it's my intent to make sure that things like that get paid off. But also, I happen to come from the school, which is comics are a serialized form, and it's okay to leave a few strands there for people to pick up later on. I mean, the whole idea in Hush was to introduce Hush. And yes, at the end of that story, Jason Todd's body is missing, and the Riddler clearly knows where it is. That's all you know. I don't feel like if you finish Hush that you're throwing the book against the wall going, where's Jason Todd's body? I couldn't possibly enjoy the whole story without it. But my job is to hopefully get you so that you're going to come back. And if there weren't Hush, then this Black Hood, then the Red Hood story that's going on right now that Jed's doing a terrific job on doesn't exist.
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe it does. It just doesn't have that other piece. That doesn't mean at the end of the day that you can't read the Red Hood story never having read Hush. And that's the way comics should be.
Sure.
You know, I mean, particularly of late, my background has been in television, and, you know, the idea is to get people to tune in next week. But that doesn't mean that you're going to find out all the answers next week. And that's how you remain fresh and alive. And, you know, the only thing that you can be sure of is that there's going to be another issue next month. It may not come out on time, but
that's the
whole point.
No, I understand. You mentioned your TV background. You've left Smallville, and now you're writing Lost, or you're a supervising producer on Lost.
I am, which is a highfalutin way of saying that, you know, in television there's a writer's room, and what we do is we sit in the room and tell stories and come up with what's going to happen to all those people on the island and those kinds of things, and we create things, and Carl Hughes, who's the executive producer of the show, and Damon Lindelof, who is the co-creator of the show and really the visionary of the show, sort of take what those of us that are in the field are doing and stir the pot around and comes up with the magic that is that show. And it's a really, really fascinating process, and it's a very, very different process than it was at Smallville, and probably closer to what it was like at Buffy, because Joss had a very singular vision and knew how to do it, and the trick was to get into that mindset so that you could help free up those ideas. Otherwise, you know, what's the point in having a writing staff? You just might as well write all the episodes yourself.
Sure.
Which nobody can do, and actually produce the show and do casting and editing and all that other stuff, because you would just collapse. And hopefully, because you're interacting with other people, and you've got a writing staff that's as talented as the Lost writing staff is, you're going to hear some ideas that are really cool and can be incorporated into Damon's vision. But clearly it works, because I don't know about you, but I'm obsessed with the show.
Big fan.
And even now that I know, you know, what's going on, I'm still obsessed with the show. And I think most of us that are on the show feel that way, that it really is such an odd mix of so many different genres and styles and characters that anything can happen, and usually does. But there's a very, very detailed, thought-out plan that is doled out very, very carefully. And that part fascinates me, and that part is, I think, where the line between what I do in comics and the line between what I do in television becomes very, very close to each other, because I do understand the concept of you can't tell everything all at once and expect anybody to show up next week.
When will we be seeing your episodes or episodes that you feel that you had a big imprint on?
January, I think.
Okay.
Is where it is. I'm about six episodes ahead of, or five, I think now, ahead of what you'll see tonight.
Uh-huh.
And I don't know when this airs, but I can just tell you that the episode that airs tonight is one of the most intense things I've watched since the pilot.
Wow, that's the November 16th episode for people who are listening. You know, all the major networks seem to have at least figured out what one of the things that make Lost and Desperate Housewives interesting, and that is that overarching story of each season. And they've responded with sci-fi shows and other shows as well with long story arcs. Do you think that they understand, too, that they then have to commit to these shows beyond that usual three episodes, and if we don't see a an audience, we're yanking the show? Because these are involved stories.
No. At the end of the day, as they say, there's no business like show business, no business at all. And the reality is you can start down a path of the most intriguing possibility of a serial story, and if nobody watches it, goodbye. And the 4 million, 8 million, 12 million people that were watching it, sorry. If you ever want to find out what happened, hopefully the guy that created the show tours and can, and tell you what happened. But it is a very difficult thing. And part of the other thing is that we live in a world where television's expensive and you've got to look for as much revenue as you can. And one of the things that generally happens in syndication is it's difficult to do a serialized story in syndication because it means that the aftermarket, as it's referred to, after it's gone off network, finds itself having to run the shows in order. And if you have to run the shows in order, then that's not as attractive as being able to run it whenever you want to.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things why there's so much Law and Order is that you can just put Law and Order on any time, any season, different cast, it doesn't matter. They're completely self-contained little stories.
Mm-hmm.
And they're extremely well done, but there's no need to worry about what's going to happen next episode. None of those characters are going anywhere. But by the same token, I don't see people rushing out to buy season one of Law and Order on DVD.
Sure.
And that's the whole new market. And the Lost season one DVD is one of the most successful television DVDs ever. I think people are really, really enjoying the fact that they can watch the show and then at the end of the series collect the whole thing and then sit and blow their minds out by watching 25 hours of television in 3 days and calling into work going, I'm sick. Come on. Now, what was Hurley doing?
Let's go back to comic books for a second. And tying into TV, because you wrote some great episodes of Smallville and some very important touchstone episodes. Great things like, was it Insurgents, where Clark took his first leap over a tall building?
Sure.
And Red, of course.
Al Goffin and Miles Miller, who developed the show, were always very, very generous to me in terms of the episodes that I got to do. The way it works in a writer's room, there's no guarantee that the next writer up is the next writer up. It's not like a batting order.
Okay.
And what they tend to try to do is attach the right writer for the right script. And so that means sometimes, it gets blipped. If I have any regrets about working at Smallville, is that I didn't get to write more episodes, but it became very, very clear early on that my value was in the room. And my value was in breaking story and moving things along. Breaking story is actually sort of a misnomer, because what you're actually doing is building the story.
Okay.
But it's called breaking a story because, you know, if you think about the legend that is Michelangelo, which is that he would stare at a block of marble for weeks on end and then suddenly stand up and start chiseling, because in his mind, the statue was in the block. And what you need to do is just chip away everything and it'll appear. That's kind of what it is to break a story. I mean, you have the elements, you know that these characters are going to be in it, and you know where you want to be at the beginning and where you want to be at the end. Now you need to, you know, come up with 22 scenes that will get you there. And it's not all that different from when you break a comic book story. You know, I mean, it's 22 pages, and you know, it can all be one big long fight scene, or it can all be one big long scene of Peter Parker talking to Aunt May on a park bench. And if it, you do it well, those are the ones that people really remember. But when I was working on Smallville, you know, my responsibilities more and more would turn to being in the room and keeping things moving. And part of that is that when you go off to write a script, you're gone for a week and sometimes 2 weeks. And in the opinion of the people that ran the show, I was more valuable working on all the episodes than working on individual episodes. So it was fun in a certain extent, in that I, you know, I can still watch the show and look at that and go, oh, that was, I don't know when that happened.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't, even on the episodes that I wrote, I don't take, it's not as though I just thought of it, went home and wrote it. You know, there's, you know, an expression that we used there, and I believe you use on any show, which is, there's no I in team, but there is in dick. I hope you can say that on the radio.
You can say anything you want. That's fine. This is the internet. Feel free.
The thing about it is I don't believe in, yeah, that was my idea, that was my idea, that was my idea. I mean, am I capable of doing that when I'm sitting at home and I'm talking to my daughter? Sure. Yeah. But
it takes a village.
What's the point? It does take a village. I mean, and that's really the enjoyable thing. I mean, I've worked as a screenwriter for years, and being a screenwriter is a very, very lonely profession. It's just you in the box. And television, series television in particular, is extremely invigorating, because it's like a train that is not going to stop no matter what. You know, you just, it starts out slow and then it starts going faster and faster and faster until you get to the last episode, and then you take a break, and then you come back, and you're at it again. And there's no real margin for error. The schedule is too tight for you to just say, oh, well, we'll just have a fill-in issue here, or we'll run a repeat. You don't get to do that. You know, you've got to find the story. And that, to me, is exciting and what I do well. So I'm really, really lucky. You know, the situation with Lost came at a very important time to me. It was a very personal time. I don't know how many people know that I lost my son this year. And after that, which is the reason why I didn't return to Smallville. They wanted me to come, but it all fell on top of each other. And Alan Miles, again, were gentlemen and said, you know, if you want to come back, just let us know. And I didn't know that I wanted to go back to work. It was one of those things where I took maybe too little time off. I don't know yet. I'll let you know a year from now.
No, I understand.
And then the people from Lost called out of the blue and asked whether or not I would join them. And I met with them, and it was exciting and new and different. And I knew in my heart that if I went back to Smallville, because my son was such a presence there, I mean, in such a way that they dedicated the first episode of the season to him.
That was a great tribute.
And that was because he was there all the time. I mean, every Friday he came in, he would sit in the writer's room. He was friends with everybody. You know, we would go out on Friday nights for dinner and drinks, and yes, he had Diet Coke. but he really felt like he was part of that. And one of the unique things about Sam was that he could hold a conversation with you, and everyone who knew him would say, like, in the middle of the conversation, they would go, wait, you're 17, right? Or you're 16, or you're 15. because it was just the way he was. And I miss that magic in ways that people can't begin to understand, and nor should they ever. And I'm now trying to sort of incorporate what I can into my life. It's not like getting divorced, you know, where it's something you need to get over. It's something that you don't get over. It's something that stays with you and affects you, and it's who you are. And part of what enabled me to go on Lost, there's a scene at the end of the third episode where Kate, who's a fugitive, has been essentially discovered by Jack, the doctor, and she's worried that he's going to out her to everybody.
Mm-hmm.
And they sit on the beach at the end, and she asks him a favor that he not say anything to anybody. And Jack says, as far as I'm concerned, when that plane crashed, we all died. And whatever happens afterwards is what happens afterwards. And that's when I went to go meet with Damon and Carlton, and when I met with the network in the studio, I was very blunt. I said, I've had my plane crash. I know what that feels like. And now it's about how I live my life. And I believe that I can live my life in an effective way by telling stories on Lost and continuing with my comics and whatever else I happen to commit myself to and not blow my brains out.
No, I understand. It's the toughest thing a parent can go through, obviously, losing a child. And I think Sam's memory is being honored by things like the Smallville Tribute and also by the 26th issue of Superman Batman. Is that still happening?
You know, there's still some stuff because it's extremely complicated. But yes, DC has been unbelievably cooperative. Sam had written the plot for 26, but, you know, it was not a complete script in terms of dialogue and things like that. And so, and this is all subject to change, but what happened was, you know, sort of after the funeral, everybody that knew Sam that worked in the comic book industry, and again, it was very much like he was in the television business where he made his own friends. And these people came to me and said, what can we do? And we didn't want to do a tribute book, but the idea was sort of based on in the 70s and 80s when someone would get behind over at Marvel, there were a group of guys called the Krusty Bunkers whose identities were never really given out, who would come in and sort of finish the book.
I see.
So that the person who did it would both get paid and, you know, and be able to stay on schedule. And, you know, our take on it was all these people are banding together. And when I say all these people, it's, you know, Jeff Johns and Al Heinberg and Arthur Hayden and Joss Whedon and Brad Meltzer and Brian Vaughn and Joe Kelly and on the writing side, and there's other people I'm forgetting, and you know, on the art side, you know, it's Jim Lee and it's Mike Burner and it's Ian Churchill and it's Ed McGuinness and it's Carlos Pacheco, and you know, I'm forgetting other people as well. I mean, the idea was to try to find 26 participants, and we'll get close. I know we're at 22, and then in addition to that, it'll actually be an extra long issue. Paul Levitz, the head of DC, wrote me a beautiful note afterwards and told me a story about another creator who had lost a child and how the advice was given to him to try to incorporate it in his work. And I didn't think that I could have that in me, but I finally sat down about a week later and I wrote a story in the same period and look of Superman for All Seasons called Sam's Story, and it's the story of a relationship between a boy who has cancer and Clark and what happens to him. And it's just six pages, but Tim sailed through it, I think, beautifully and got all of the emotion of what it was. And that, more than anything, is that part is absolutely a tribute to my son. But we wanted something that would, you know, be very, the story that he came up with was very light and fun and very much like the way he was, and and then we wanted a story that was the backup that would put it all in perspective. And I think when the package all comes together, it'll be pretty impressive, over and beyond the fact that, you know, it's sort of a who's who that's working in comics. And that there were other people who wanted to be involved, and it really just came down to whether or not they'd had a relationship with Sam. You know, there's a lot of people that I really, really respect in the business that I know that would come in and pitch in. But it wasn't about that. Like I said, it wasn't about making a tribute book or a 9/11 book or something like that. It was really about, hey, our friend Sam didn't get to finish this.
Yeah.
Why don't we all work together and finish it up for him? And then the part that's very exciting to me is that we've created a scholarship fund.
Wow.
At the high school that we went to, and DC has already made a substantial donation to that fund. And every one of the artists and writers are donating their fees and their royalties, which, as you can imagine, on a book like that, would be quite significant. And all of the artists have agreed to turn the artwork over to the fund, and there will be an auction at some point next year where all of that will be auctioned off, and then all of that will go into the fund, and we will be giving out a scholarship at his high school, hopefully every year for at least the next 10 years. That's the plan.
Wow, that's terrific, Jeff. That's amazing.
More of that information will come out. But the only reason why I'm sort of reluctant to sort of blow it all out is that it's not, you know, it's greenlit, but there are no contracts. And until those are all done, and as you can imagine, that many people being involved in something that large but still that small is a lot of paperwork. And DC has been terrific in trying to sort of pull it all together at a time when, as you can imagine, it's nuts up there. I can't be more appreciative of the hard work that Dan DiDio and Terry Cunningham and Jack Mahan and Paul Levitz are putting into this project. And I think, again, that's a testament to my son, not myself. That, you know, they all knew him and they all knew what he was capable of, and I think they want to do right by him.
That's really cool.
So.
Well, we look forward to the updates on that, and as more information comes to light, certainly my site will be giving information where people can learn more about that.
Thanks, Matt. I appreciate it.
Let me ask about jumping to Marvel. You know, everyone knows that you're working on the Ultimates. I'll just ask you, what can you tell us about your plans for the Ultimates?
I can tell you that because I can tell you a number of things. One, none of this exists in a vacuum. I began down this journey by having lots and lots of conversations with Mark Millar, but unfortunately, because of his Scottish accent, I couldn't understand what the hell he was saying, so that really was of no use to me whatsoever. So we started emailing each other, and he writes in Scottish, so I didn't understand any of that either, so I'm pretty much on my own.
Okay.
Mark's a close friend, and it was one of those weird things where I sort of where I see the story starting, and he was like, "Oh, well, that's good because this is where the story's ending." And I think that one of my really sole concerns, and I try to say this in every interview I do, people are going to get to the end of Mark's run, and there are a series of twists that happen at the end that no matter what we say, people are going to say either editorial or Loeb made Mark compromise the vision at the end. And all I can tell you is that that was always the plan, and it just happened to fit right up against where I wanted to go. Had Mark decided that what he wanted to do was ended in a different way, I would have picked up those threads as well. It just happened to work out perfectly. So when the moon splits in half and the entire Earth is covered with water and the Ultimates all have gills, you'll understand that that was his idea, not mine. I didn't have anything to do with that part. The other thing that was established between Ultimates 1 and Ultimates 2 was that a year went by. So I just want to point out to everybody that the one-year-later concept, which DC then took on, was in fact copyrighted by Mark Millar over at Marvel, and how DC's dealing with that, I'm sure is going to be subject to a massive lawsuit, because the idea of having a story that takes place 1 year later was actually created by Mark Millar. No one's ever done that before. So when I do it, I cannot wait for the reaction where people go, oh, sure, he comes from DC with that 1 year later idea. But it's, again, something that I, you know, borrowed from Mark, and I think is a very helpful thing, because if nothing else, one of the delights and one of the areas of concern, I think, on the part of the fans is that, you know, is this going to be different than what Mark and Hitch are doing?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the answer is, hell yes. And that's what we all wanted. And I'm sort of delighted that Mark came up with the best metaphor of all, which is, it's like watching a new James Bond. And, you know, my hope is that we're Pierce Brosnan and that we're not George Lazenby. And I, you know, I will always be in awe of Sean Connery. And I've, you know, I've made no secret about it. I usually, when a new team is brought on a book, it's because it's broken and somebody needs to go in and fix it. And this is a case where there's nothing wrong with this. In fact, the only thing that's wrong with what Mark and Brian are doing is that they're leaving. And what I found out very early on is that they're not just leaving, they're looting the kingdom before they go. And so I get to come in and go, oh, great. So all the oil fields are on fire and there's no gear. So I need to, you know, figure out what to do from there. But it's, you know, the story will probably be a little less political minded because Noir's, you know, pinko, liberal, anti-American slander that he made the book into a monster hit is not something that I would ever attempt to try to do. And people, I think, expect from me and Joe Mad a book that's a little bit more on the superhero-y side. That doesn't mean the book is turning into the Avengers. And it also doesn't mean that it's not going to have some topical and hot buttons that will get people excited, you know. But the things that interest me are not the same things that interest Mark. Mm-hmm. And or they do, and he chose not to talk about them. And that's, to me, that it's just as interesting to look at the morality in the country and the division between the right and the left. And, you know, there's a very, very natural division within the team in terms of what is acceptable behavior and what is not acceptable behavior.
Mm-hmm.
And what does that mean when you're a public figure? And so in that way, it will have its currentness. We're just not going to be invading Iraq, in case anybody's wondering. if for no other reason that it's been done. In fact, it's been done twice by the administration, and it's been done once in Mark's book. So, you know, my take on all of it is that that's where he was going and will be going in some new and, I think, extremely exciting places. There will be some changes to the team. There are things that happen at the end of Mark's run which necessitated that, and there are things that happen in the year that you don't get to see, which will unfold. I mean, part of the other thing I can tell you is that Ultimates 3.1, you're going to be walking into the middle of a movie, and it's going to take a little while for you to catch up and find out, well, who's that, and how did they get on a team, and, you know, and we're such and such a person, and I don't understand yet, but it'll come, and hopefully it won't be confusing, and hopefully you'll go, oh, cool, that's who's on the team now, well, what happened, what's his face, and you'll slowly, it'll unravel, and you'll see what the situations are. But all of it was drawn out of the really extraordinary characters that Mark and Hitch created. You know, one of the things that I've often said is that Mark, in the first 24 issues of this thing, really set up all of the character work,
mm-hmm.
which is really the hard stuff. And now it's sort of like stretching the rubber band as far as you can stretch it. And now it's time for me to sort of let the rubber band spring, which is the other reason why I think we can move into a more action-y type situation, because you'll know who these people are if you've been reading the book. And
right.
If you haven't been reading the book, you'll catch on fairly quickly, because it's not as though I'm just going to let people run around. And I also, before they come to my house with torches, I just want to point out that if you go back and you look at some of my favorite issues of the Ultimates, the Hank Pym Defenders issue, that's 2.6.
Very funny.
And, you know, there's narration through that entire book, so that when people see that there may or may not be narration in my book, that it is not the only thing that I do. which I am often accused of. And I, you know, it's a style, and it's what happened. I'm actually, in the case of Batman, I inherited it.
Sure.
My first Batman script that I, Archie Goodwin, the late great editor who really, really put me on the map,
mm-hmm.
I, you know, said to me, "You're doing a Legends of the Dark Knight story." And I said, "Yeah." So, he said, "Well, one of the conceits of the book is that there's a narrator." And I said, "Oh, okay." And so that, I inherited that the first time. And then, you know, as I've often told people, the story of Superman for All Seasons is that the joke is that the average time that it takes to read a comic book is the time that it takes for you to sit on the toilet and do number two. But to read a Jeff Loeb comic is, you know, the time that it takes for you to do number one. And the problem was is that when you read the first issue of Superman for All Seasons, even though it was 48 pages, you didn't even get your zipper down. And I panicked and tried to sort of find a way to slow it down and to give it more emotional weight because the pictures were just so beautiful.
Absolutely.
And I wrote first the page where Martha is on the porch and she's looking out at Jonathan and Clark, who are out in the field, and they're having the conversation about the Rocket, where he comes from and why he has powers and why he's different. And Jonathan is narrating the story for that one page. I just wanted to see how it would work. And it, you know, with anyone who knows me, if you go and read that page, that is about my son. Those were things that happened with my son. And at the time, you know, my boy was 4 or 5 years old.
Wow.
And so I then sort of grew out of that, and it very much became a story about a father and a son, and a father who has to let go of his son so that the world can have him, which, again, was something that I knew even then I would have to do with Sam. I just didn't know that I was going to have to do it prematurely. And unfortunately, the world will never really get the full impact of what it was that he would have done, because I believe in my heart that he was someone that would have changed the world. And so that narration was an afterthought. And I had already written the scripts for 2 and 3. So I went in and did the Lois narration and the Lex narration for books 2 and 3. And 4 was the first one that I actually wrote with narration in it. And that's part of my process anyway. I write a full script with descriptions of every single panel because that's all I know how to do from screenwriting.
Mm-hmm.
I also do what I call a pass of the dialogue, mostly so that the artist knows two things. One, how many balloons are going to be in this panel? And two, you know, you can put, you know, in the description, close on Batman, he looks grimmer than he's ever looked before, and that's helpful, but more helpful is Batman whispering, "I'm going to kill you." That's a better way for the artist to know, okay, now I know exactly what the expression is going to be on his face. Now, I may get the artwork before it goes to the letterer, and I get one more pass. And I may get to that panel and look at it and go, okay, actually by putting the balloon that says I'm going to kill you is going to lessen the impact of that, and I get rid of it. Or I look at it and go, I wrote that a month and a half ago, and now that I'm looking at it, I think a better line would be Alfred, and I'll change it. So sometimes the script that the artist works from goes right to Richard Starkings, my letterer. Good luck, John. And sometimes it's been completely rewritten, like entire scenes, even though the artwork looks exactly the same, what people say is completely different because something happened in the artwork or something happened to the story as I was thinking about it. And I hope that always that makes for a better story. I don't like making changes just to make a change.
I like your dual narration on Batman Superman because they are different people. And it seems like your voice for Superman came from your relationship with Elliot S. Magan.
It's really weird. It probably does simply because those are the books that I grew up with, and
mm-hmm.
that's the voice that's, you know, I mean, it's kind of like when you write for a movie star, you tend to sit down and watch everything that they've ever done, and
sure.
then eventually their voice becomes the voice in your head. I certainly grew up reading all of Elliot's stuff, and it influences me in ways that I'm probably not really aware, but the highest compliment that Elliot ever paid me was that when I was working on Challengers of the Unknown, which was my first comic,
yes,
and I really didn't know what the hell I was doing at all. And poor Tim, who had to suffer through all of it.
It's a great book, man.
In the second issue, Superman comes and, you know, essentially testifies that while he doesn't know the challenges of the unknown, what he does know is that whenever you're a hero, every single time you go out there, you run the risk of making a mistake, and when you make a mistake, people get hurt.
Right.
And that's an awesome responsibility to take on. And I just wrote all of this, and Elliot made a copy of my script and circled the Superman dialogue and said, there will come a time when people will look back and read this and understand that you have written some of the most definitive Superman dialogue ever done. And Elliot is both very generous and extremely hyperbolic, but I think what he was trying to say at the time was, you know, for a guy who's never written a comic book, you sure seem to have this guy's voice. And I never really thought about it at all. It just sort of felt like that's what he sounds like. And I can't really explain that other than, you know, that's the way it is. And it resonates for some people, and for some people, you know, they, you know, it's different. But I'm happy that for more people, it works than people who don't. Otherwise, I wouldn't have a job.
I was wondering where your voice for Batman may have came from. I guess the same place then. You know, as far as
reading. I've made no secret about it. I'm a huge fan of Denny and Neil Adams, Denny O'Neil and Neil Adams, mm-hmm. and those books impacted me enormously. I also, you know, you spend 3 years working with Archie Goodwin, and if nothing wears off on you, then you haven't spent 3 years with Archie Goodwin. And, you know, he was just not only a great editor, he's a brilliant writer. And so, you know, I would turn my scripts in, and there would be one little tiny thing. I remember, I think it's the first Halloween special. It may have been the second one. There's a moment where Bruce wakes up and goes into the bathroom and vomits. And obviously you don't see him vomit. So all you see is sort of an open door. And, you know, in a 48 or 60, 72 page story, Archie had that one moment where he just said, could you just, it feels like in the narration, you just need like a, I remember how cold the porcelain felt. And that was just exactly right. You know, I mean, it was just the thing that scene needed. And that's really what a really good editor gives to you, which is not, this whole thing needs to be rewritten, but if you know, put a grace note here, mm-hmm. it'll all tie together. And, you know, I think the secret with Batman is less is more. You know, he is not a big chatty guy, and is pretty just on one level, which is, I made a promise to my parents to rid the city of the evil that took their lives. That's it. And as long as every single scene is about that, you'll be fine. You know, that's why he can't love, and that's why he's rude to people, and that's why he's mysterious in the night, and that he doesn't talk, and, you know, all those things all come together. Whereas Clark, you know, he's basically a farm boy, you know, who was taught to be polite to everybody and to help people out. And that's his natural inclination. That's the way he was raised. So you have two people, one who's completely emotionally cut off, and you have another one who's completely emotionally open. And for me, that makes great drama, and it also happens to make great comedy. And I find them very, very funny, and they're intended to be funny. Even when you read it, you go, well, that's not funny. You know, sort of go, well, it is if you think about it. And, you know, they're not Butch Cassidy and Sundance Kid, and they're not the guys in Lethal Weapon, but they're very aware of how they see each other. Very much the kind of way that brothers see each other. You know, it's that loving kind of thing, which is, you know, he sure is smart, but boy, is he an idiot. And that just works for me really well.
Well, that's self-evident.
Well, I'm glad that, you know, all I try to do is write the best story that I can and hope that people like it. I can't do anything more than that. If I felt like someone read the story and went, well, just hack this out, that would bother me. Because that's not what I do, and that's not what I would do. And also, I'm very lucky in the case of most of the time I was at DC, I was working with Eddie Braganza, and Eddie won't allow it. I mean, he'd kick a script back at 18 seconds if he thought you hacked it out. And I know that a lot of people are sitting there going, well, that's not possible. And you go, well, it is, And then there are realities, which is, you know, this book has to ship. So you can't continually just say, no, make it better. And at a certain point, people have limitations. I've just been very lucky that I work with an editor who sees the characters pretty much the same way I do. And so, you know, it's kind of like writing music that he plays on a piano. It makes sense to him so that we can go on. And I'm just starting to have this relationship with Ralph Macchio over at Marvel in the Ultimate Universe. And it's a learning curve for both of us. But I'm also finding out that, again, he has this very, very unique and a very helpful perspective on all of the characters, and that's going to help me sort of stay in between the lines. And that's, again, in my mind, what a good editor does. I don't need someone to write the story for me. I need someone to sort of go, look at this scene and see whether or not there's a little more you could do here. And, you know, coming all the way back to television, that's a lot of what I do in the room, which is that when we're talking about a scene and we think it's baked, just sitting back and looking at it and going, is there one more emotional turn here? Is there one line that will just make the audience go, oh, what does that mean? Or, wow, that's incredibly sad. Or, wow, that's incredibly funny. It's just looking for those beats. Because regardless of the fact that I am the proverbial guy who, when you ask what time it is, will tell you it's a clock. And actually, it will be more than a clock. It will be more like the fucking Ben. Sorry about the language. But I do find words to be very, very precious when you write them, and that you need to use them sparingly and effectively. And I'm, again, I'm incredibly lucky to work with, you know, people like Al and Miles over at Smallville and Joss over at Buffy and now Damon and Carlton over at Lost. I mean, these are guys that, you know, anybody not only could learn from, but should learn from. And that's the part that makes it enjoyable and why I like going to work. I don't like being the smartest person in the room. It's not fun because there's nothing to challenge you. And I know what it's like to be a parent, and I don't want to be a parent. So instead, if you can put together a crew of people that are not only your peers, but in many cases are smarter than you are, it brings up your game. It's like if you're going to play tennis, you want to play tennis against somebody that's better than you, not somebody that you can beat.
Sure.
And that's the part that makes it exciting.
You mentioned Buffy, and I guess I have to ask what the progress is, if any, on the Buffy cartoon.
Well, and my standard line is that the best Buffy episodes are about resurrection. And, you know, it's no secret that we've started and stopped about 14 times.
Yeah.
all I can tell you is that it's all there. You know, the first season is ready to go when someone pulls the trigger. And it currently is not happening, but could. And that's part of the reason why I say that is that material that's that good and has that many talented people that are involved and you know, all of the scripts are written by, with exception of the pilot that was written by me and Joss, all of the scripts are written by the Buffy writers. So they're just these wonderful tales that are stories that take place in between the stories you already know.
Mm-hmm.
And there's that theme again. And Joss was and is intimately involved in it, as he is with all things Buffy. Eric Radomski, who was one of the creative forces behind Batman Animated and all of its things that grew out of that, and at the same time, did Spawn Animated as well, and it just has that ability to reinvent animation all the time, has done tremendous work on the design of the show. Eric White, who's one of the most talented guys I've ever met, did all the character design work, and I think if people saw, you know, how many scripts and how much artwork and how much everything was all put together before the plug was pulled, they would just be bewildered why they haven't seen it. And that's why I just think there will come a time where people are standing around going, why don't we do Buffy Animated? Because as Joss and I used to joke, is that it's as though we have this big, big pile of money that's sitting in the middle of the parking lot at 20th Century Fox. And we're standing there with sort of Coyote and Roadrunner sign sticking out of it that says, free money, come take it. And people are coming up to us going, do you have copper pan? And we're going, no, but we have free money. No, we want copper pan. So eventually someone will come over and say, we want free money. And we'll go, oh, great. Well, here's Buffy Animated. So I will never say die.
Attaboy. Well, that's cool. We hope it happens. What about the Spirit work that you started to work on? Is the Marvel projects, are they going to affect your ability to...
No. The all that stuff is still in the motion. And because some of the stuff is still being sort of worked out, those are things that... this is a case where I have to be vague.
Okay.
Simply because that's the way it is. I mean, what I can say is that the one project I can talk about is that the Batman Spirit Cross that Darwin Cook is doing with me. There is a full plot. It is a 40-page story. And Darwin is completely out of his mind because he's going to be drawing everyone in the Batman universe and everyone in the Spirit universe.
Wow.
And it's just as cool as hell, and it's everybody that you want to see. I mean, it's everyone from Clarion and the Octopus and the Cossack on the Spirit side, and, you know, Pigalle and Satin and all those people, so they're all there. And on the other side, there's, you know, Catwoman and the Joker and, you know, you name it, and the Rogues Gallery, and they all come together and clash, and there's still the fun of, you know, Commissioner Dolan and Commissioner Gordon and Ellen and Barbara and Ebony and Robin. And, you know, and for me, it all came down to that, you know, that moment where, you know, Robin looks at Pigalle like, wow, I've never seen one of you before. And she sort of twirls his hair and he's got big heart balls in his eyes. And, you know, Batman's basically going, you know, okay, time to leave. It's also just an interesting collision of styles because Eisner had an enormous impact on the way that people like Frank Miller, and who helped redefine the character in many ways, and Mazzucchelli, and, you know, just hundreds of artists through the years have looked at Batman and were affected by the way that graphic storytelling is told by Eisner. So that's their cousins to begin with. But you know, Eisner always did everything with a little style and a little wit, and there was always that element to it. And there was also, you know, in a really good Spirit story, you know, he gets punched and kicked and thrown down a flight of stairs. And I mean, for me, you know, the typical Spirit scene, or sort of the ultimate Spirit scene, is that, you know, there's a beautiful girl and a thug who are, you know, have got the Spirit tied up and are knocking him around because they're trying to find out what happened to their money. And the thug hits him too hard. He's tied up in a chair, and it's like hits him too hard, and the Spirit tumbles out the window with the chair three stories up and crashes down on the steps out front. At which point, you know, the policeman on the block realizes that somebody just got thrown out a window, and they all come running in. And as they come running in, the thug, in an effort to get away, comes running out the front door, trips over the Spirit's body, knocks himself out, and the Spirit stands up and says, well, here he is, boys, and then he's got to go after the girl. And then the question is, you know, did the Spirit throw himself out the window, or did he just happen to get knocked out the window? And that's the brilliance that Eisner brought to it.
Did you have a chance to write any of those new adventures of the Spirit that they did in the 90s?
I did not.
Okay.
But there will be, in one of the projects that I'm being vague about, a wonderful opportunity to do something with, I think, the perfect artist. So,
cool.
When we get there, we can talk about that.
How about the screenplay?
Same thing.
Okay.
It's something that's
left vague.
In the hands of the people that are the producers and the studio. I can tell you that they are exactly the right people to make the movie and intend to do the Eisners right. And I don't think that Will, who unfortunately passed away before any of this could come together, his wife, and Dennis Kitchen, who runs the Eisner estate, would have trusted Michael Uslan with those rights unless he honestly believed that they were going to make the movie that they're going to make. And that's exciting to me.
Absolutely. No, that's cool. And yeah, I think Darwin is the right guy to the right look for Spirit comic books and everything. So I'm looking forward to all those projects. Do you think there's a Marvel equivalence as far as an iconic team-up in the way that you set up that Batman-Superman dynamic?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's. I don't know that it flows as naturally, you know, but certainly in terms of differences in the way things approach it, you know, Spider-Man and Wolverine, if you can find a way to put them together, are as diametrically opposed but want to accomplish the same goal, and that's interesting. But I don't. One of the things about the Marvel Universe which makes it the Marvel Universe is that there's no sort of singular, there is no Superman, there is no Batman, there is no one singular hero that defines the entire group, that everything comes from that person. And I think that that stems from the fact that, you know, when Stan and Jack were creating all this stuff, like when you look at what came out of their minds, I mean, the Fantastic Four and you know, Spider-Man really being the only single character until they came up with Daredevil. But, you know, the Fantastic Four had four characters, and the X-Men had five, and Charles Xavier, and a whole group of Brotherhood of Evil Mutants. And then, you know, meanwhile, they decided, okay, well, let's put the Avengers together, and now you've got five more characters that are running around. And I think that the concept of the group as family plays much stronger in the Marvel Universe. And I think in the same kind of way that I can't really off the top of my head think in the DCU that there's sort of the equivalent of the Fantastic Four, there's no real hard equivalent of the world's finest duo. But there are ways to tell those kinds of stories without it being that way. And personally, the way that I see Cap and Tony, Iron Man, is as Superman and Batman, and that Cap is very single-minded and very closed off and very much about, even though he's this iconic figure that everyone looks up to, he really is, it's my way or the highway kind of guy. And on the other hand, you know, Tony Stark is continually trying to help people and building groups and surrounding himself. And, you know, that's why it just, it's so perfect that that's the character who has the heart that continues to break. in the same kind of way that that's what Superman was all about. And, you know, there's this wonderful scene in Young Avengers, Al Heinberg's book, very early on, where Cap and Iron Man is flying, holding Cap, and they sort of land on top of the Bugle, or I think that's where they are. And if you look at that scene, that is a Superman-Batman scene. You know, Iron Man flies in carrying Cap. I don't remember that ever happening before. And Cap is stoic, and there's no way that these kids are going to stay being heroes, and Iron Man is taking on all of the blame because the Avengers died because he created the Avengers, which is, you know, a little bit like Clark feeling guilty that, you know, there's kryptonite on Earth. Clark, he didn't really have a whole lot to do about that.
You were always so much fun at DC as the attack dog, to kind of balance out, and it's all in fun, and at least the more knowledgeable fans realize that when you guys swipe back and forth, DC and Marvel, it's all just talk, and if anything, it all just helps, you know, sell more books. But it's so funny, because you mentioned politics before, you're kind of like Zell Miller. All of a sudden, you know, all these years of building up this DC cred of being this attack guy, and now all of a sudden, wait a minute, you're on the other side of the aisle, man. What the hell happened?
And you know what? The finger pointing remains the same. I'll still make fun of Marvel, and I'll still make fun of DC. You know, I think the part that people didn't always catch was that, you know, I continually made fun of the people at DC. It was just the stuff that got more play was when I poked the finger at Marvel. And again, a lot of that doesn't happen without somebody like Joe Quesada, who's, you know, one of my dearest friends. And,
sure.
You know, and he and I would talk about it. And even just, like, some of the ones that got really out of control was like when I would get on a panel with Bill Jemis, and, you know, and I would just go, Bill, please, you know, stop smoking whatever it is you're smoking and come back to reality. But what no one ever knew was that he and I would meet beforehand in the bar and have a drink, and he would say, I'm planning on saying this, and I would go, okay, well, then you just better be prepared that I'm going to hit you in the head with a 2x4. And he would go ahead, make it a big one. And that was the show. And,
absolutely.
And yes, some people get it and some people don't. But, you know, this is not, we didn't start this. You know, I mean, part of the fun of Stan and Jack and Rascally Roy was not only making fun of themselves, but also making fun of the distinguished competition. And they did it all the time.
Sure.
And, you know, I mean, for me, it goes back to my childhood reading Mad Magazine, where, you know, they would have all the writers, and then it would say, "And the usual gang of idiots." And that, to me, was like, that's what we are. It's just a gang of idiots that are having a lot of fun. I mean, come on, we're grown men. We get to write comics. Well, what's better than that? Well, sex, but that's a point. And certain foods.
Certain foods. Well, I hope you train somebody at DC to kind of, you know, pick up the slack.
It's not something that, it may be a time that's passed. You know, I mean, look, you get Greg Rucka riled up and he'll take on the world, and I think that's fun and hilarious.
Absolutely.
And you know, if Jeff wanted to, he could. But I think he's still trying to win the Nobel Peace Prize for, you know, nicest guy in comics. He's been nominated 4 times, but Joe Kelly keeps winning. You know, I mean, I just take all of that stuff and, you know, and again, I think that what's hard is guys that are really the best at it, like Dan DiDio and Joe Quesada, just have to be really careful because there's officers at the company. And so you can't just come right out and just say, "I think that guy's a jerk," because it doesn't play well in the press, because that kind of stuff actually winds up on the front page of the New York Times.
Sure, sure. Yeah.
But, you know, I'm just, you know, some peon writer that they could fire at any moment, so I can say anything I want. and ultimately go, you know, it's a joke, guys. You know, I mean, Bendis and I and Noir and I are, you know, like, these are my buddies. These are the guys I hang with. So if I can't make fun of them, then what's the point? And I can't make fun of people that I don't respect and that I don't think that their books are smart and making it go. You know, it's sort of like the fun is picking on the kid that's skinny. You know, you got to pick on the biggest guy in the room, and if he turns around and punches you in the nose, you know, that's what you get.
Will your TV writing schedule allow you to be part of these Marvel writing jam sessions that are so notorious? And obviously you did the same thing at DC. But with your current schedule, are you going to have enough time to influence?
I had to do the same thing when I was at
Smallville.
At DC. And I was at Smallville for 3 years. And, you know, you try to make your schedule work. Sometimes I can't be as intimately involved as I'd like to be. Because I'm on show, but also, you know, the show is not year-round. And, you know, we have long periods of hiatus, and during that time I can get in there. And also, you know, we live in a world now where there's so much on the net and there's so much that's done on phone that, you know, it's just as easy for me to pick up the phone and be part of a conversation as is anything else. And as I think you've discovered from this interview, a little of me goes a long way. And so sometimes it's better to have me come in at the end of the day and have people go, "Well, this is what we're thinking about," and have me go, "That's great. I love that. What if we put this in there?" Or, you know, "What if Batman was this character instead of the Phantom Stranger?" And, you know, most of the times I just get laughed out of the room. But, you know, the last Marvel hoo-ha where, you know, this major storyline that's coming, that begins with Bendis's Illuminati one-shot that they just announced. You know, that all grew out of conversations that we had when we were back in New York. They happened very quickly. I think people have this idea that we go to an island for 3 weeks. You know, it's basically the first day is where everyone just sort of regurgitates everything that they have inside of them, and then you sort of look at it and go, okay, is there anything here other than vomit? And then by day two, like you realize, oh wow, look at that! There's a diamond ring there, and next to it is a Krugerrand, and you build from there. And then sort of by day three, you're kind of patting yourself on the back, going, "Geez, what geniuses we are!" And then we leave, and then Bendis thinks about it for a while and fixes it.
Well, Well, that's cool. Are there any other Marvel books that you can mention that you might have coming up beyond Ultimates, or is everything still hush-hush until big announcements?
The latter would be true.
Okay.
Look, I'm not trying to be cutie.
No.
Cry about it, but the reality is, like, even just the Ultimates, you know, we're not going to see that until sometime next year. And,
right.
You know, but when we first decided, let's announce something, first of all, we had Joe Madd, and that was just too hot not to let people see.
Very cool.
But second of all, it was just one of those situations where I felt like, well, hell, if they're going to start talking about Spider-Man 3, which comes out in the summer of 2007 now, and you can keep it hot, then let's keep it hot. Let's keep doling out little pieces of information along the way and give people something to talk about. The only thing that concerned me at all, and Quesada and Miller and I talked about it, was, you know, I didn't want the spotlight to come off of the end of Mark's run and Mark and Hitch's run. And oftentimes that's what happens, that, you know, people get all excited about the new team and, you know, you become what in politics is referred to as a lame duck.
Sure, sure.
But that's not happening here because the Ultimate fans are chained to Mark and Hitch's leg. And, you know, with any kind of luck, Mark's going to leave me, you know, 5,000 keys and tell me that one of them actually opens the lock, which I know is a lie anyway, so I'll just have to find a way of getting in by myself.
Break a window.
Exactly. It's all about breaking windows.
Listen, man, you gave me plenty of time and plenty of stuff, so I appreciate your time today.
Not a problem.
That's writer Jeff Loeb. Information on donations to the Sam Loeb College Scholarship Fund can be found by emailing an inquiry to samloeb4@aol.com. That'll do it for this episode of Word Balloon. Thanks a lot for listening. This is John Suntress. Word Balloon is a copyright feature of Shaky Productions, copyright 2005.